Blog Talk Radio.
This is Different Strokes for Different Folks. We've lost our regular introduction, so please bear with me. Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my special guest is an old and dear friend, Diana Marino. She's a practicing SGI Buddhist and has been doing so for the past 38 years. Professionally, she works as a leadership consultant for Fortune 500s, and on the side is an arts administrator for the Atlanta Taiko Project, a professional international drumming group. As a Buddhist leader, she spends time weekly helping other practitioners study and apply Buddhist concepts in their daily lives to become truly happy. For more information, go to www.sgi-usa.org. So, I would like to introduce Diana. How are you tonight, Diana?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for asking me to share on your show. It has been a long time, David.
Yes, it has been a long time. We've been out of communication, and we need to do something to fix that, and we can do that later. Right now, what I'd like to do is start off by exploring your background, and I thank you for agreeing to come on the show. If you're uncomfortable with any questions, that's fine. We'll just move on. The main meat of the interview is going to be around your Buddhist practice, but I'd like to start off by asking you what your family of origin was like.
Sure. When you mean family of origin, are you saying spiritually?
Well, I'd like to hear that too. I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit about what your family life was like as a young child.
Sure. Well, this is probably a very, it looked one way to the outside world, and then on the inside world, it actually was a very tumultuous and difficult place. I grew up in upstate New York, and my father was a very successful businessman, and we had lived a fairly good life, but behind the scenes, there was a tremendous amount of abuse. And I grew up being abused for about 15 years, and that really actually was the reason why I think I sought something. You know, we tend to do that when we're in a lot of pain. So I was, grew up in a very, it looked great, but then unfortunately the reality of it was a very tortured childhood. And I know many people have that, so I feel kind of happy that I'm able to share a little bit about that and what I went through through those years.
Well, I think that's important because I think that the power of people's testimony can really transcend whatever pain was out there in the past and helps in transforming oneself the more one tells one's story. And it certainly can serve as an inspiration to others who are going through traumatic times and to let them know that they're not alone. And the other thing that I wanted to comment on was how things looked okay on the outside but were not on the inside. that is such a common theme for families mm-hmm. where there's abuse, there's a lot of secret keeping going on, and they present facades to the outside world, which makes everybody feel kind of crazy.
Right.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about how you managed to survive the abuse and
yeah,
what do you think
sure.
what do you think the meaning of it was for you spiritually from today's
well,
perspective?
Well, you know, it's a difficult, you know, we always can look at something in hindsight, but it's very hard to identify what it was really like when it's your norm, I think. So
mm-hmm.
because you don't necessarily have the reality is very different than other people's reality, and how I survived. I mean, I sometimes look back and go, I don't know how I survived. But one of the great things is that I did believe that, you know, I did have love in my life, and there were people who did love me. My friends loved me. You know, I had different things that I was able to do. Actually, you know, theater was a very important part of my high school years and my junior high school years, and that acted as a form of therapy in some ways because I was able to be somebody else, which was very
mm-hmm.
important to me, I think. And but I also was very self-destructive. So I was very promiscuous. I was a burner. You know, I would have, you know, cigarette burn, you know, my hands. I mean, different things. And then I became very suicidal. And to this day, I don't think that my family is even quite aware of that, or they really, you know, they figure that's in the past. So it doesn't matter. But it was really extreme. And I was then, I had gone through lots of therapy, but was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And that was, yeah, I don't think you even knew that part yet freshman in college. And so I had, you know, really, I don't know if surviving was exactly the right word, because I had come to the point where I didn't want to survive because I was in so
mm-hmm.
much pain. And
right.
the typical things, you know, the pushing people away, the bizarre behaviors, being very able to make friends but not keep them because of the way I would treat them. And also, you know, that whole Woody Allen line, or it was either Woody Allen or it was Groucho Marx who said, you know, I don't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member, kind of thing. So I think that was just a lot of pain, a tremendous amount of pain at that time, you know, throughout my life from 3 until I was 17. That's how long the abuse mm-hmm. was going on. So it was extreme.
Well, that's awful. And yet, as you said, this happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there are always tremendous effects on the victims. And hopefully the victims can get to a place where they can find their personal power and rewrite the story. But as a helpless young child, you certainly are a victim. And it's so normal for people to act out in different ways. You talked about promiscuity and the burning. And that's such a normal thing for people to do. It's just a cry for help. And that suicidal
right.
depression, I can so relate to that. But you've come through the other side. What do you credit bringing you through that?
Right, to that point. Well, I think you asked a question earlier that I guess I didn't answer, and that was, you know, about what was the meaning for me at this
yes.
point. You know, how do I look back and see the meaning? And I think all of those two questions are tied together because – you know, I was really seeking at that point because I knew I had tried so many times to hurt myself and to, you know, do away with myself that I knew that and it really was a cry for help because I wanted to just ease the pain. So I started to really seek in religion. And, you know, at that time, this was in the 70s, there were all these, you know, books out there, you know, I'm okay, you're okay. There was, you know, just all
oh, yeah.
these things that you were looking for, as well as, you know, spiritual things. And I started looking in, I was dating someone at the time, and he was Jewish, and I was really into Judaism. And I really enjoyed Judaism. I really felt that Judaism was was a really wonderful religion. I really studied it, and then I ended up going and you know, of course, once I broke up with the boyfriend, I quit the religion. So it was sort of like sneaking on, and I thought, oh no, that one's not too good. So I went ahead and went to seek out, you know, just various different things spiritually, and came across Zen Buddhism, and also had actually gone back to my Christian faith and gone to, you know, my Catholicism, which I had originally, you know, I was raised and went to Catholic school. What happening was, it was very interesting because I remember I was really looking for a reason to live. And I remember the priest telling me that I would understand, you know, why this happened after I had died. And I thought, well, this is going to work for me because I'm really close to that edge, and thought,
yeah, okay. right.
You know, there was no answer for that for them to give me. And at that point, at that time, you know, you didn't talk about abuse, you didn't talk about those things. You know, there really was no advocate for you. So I went and started looking at Buddhism. And I started looking at Zen Buddhism and practicing it, and it was a very as wonderful. And that's when the book came out, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And I remember reading that book and thinking, oh, this is so cool. But the challenge is with Zen is it's a very difficult practice. It's not very, you know, tangible. And contemporary. It's a very ancient religion, and it also has, philosophically, you know, it's very hard to actually get something out of it unless you spend a lot of time in meditation, et cetera, and at that point, that's not what I was able to do. So what really was the big change for me is when somebody, and it was, you know, you talk about, you know, destiny, was that someone on a bus came up to me and handed me a card and said, you know, if you chant these three words, you can get anything you want. Person's a nutbag. Here I was, the nutbag, calling the other person a nutbag. So what ended up happening was, I went and I took this card and I put it away, and about 6 months later, I ran across it, and I thought, gee, this, you know, this may be something I'd be interested in. And at that time, I was in extreme turmoil. I was going to be thrown out of my college dorm. I had caused problems. There were fights. I mean, it was really, I was known as somebody who was really not well-balanced. And all of a sudden, this other person came up and said, do you know what? There's this Buddhist girl down the hall. She's having a meeting. Do you want to go? And so I did. And that was like the changing day of my life, was when I went to my first Buddhist meeting. And I know that, you know, there's a lot behind it, but that was it. That was the key pivotal point for me.
And what was the appeal for you at the time?
Well, I think that, first of all, there was a real diverse group of people there. There were, you know, every single kind of age, different kinds of people were there, which, first of all, was one major thing. The other thing is that I was desperate, and I saw in this that there was somebody had, you know, the people were really happy. They were like, you know, and they were, some of them were very strange, others really normal. It was just this incredible group of people, and they started talking about Buddhism and basically about how you yourself as an individual can create your own destiny and make your own change. You didn't need permission from something outside you. Once again, that power, right, within yourself, you can rewrite your own story. So I, you know, thought that was really, you know, great at the time, but on the other hand, I was very doubting person because I've been disappointed by so many things. And they said, you know, just try chanting. So this, you can chant for anything you want. And I thought, well, this, I don't know about this. So I did. I started practicing. I started chanting, and within like about 45 minutes, I felt hope, and I had not felt hope I think, for years. So I knew something was happening, that it was different. You know, that there was something coming from inside me that was different than anything I'd ever experienced. And that was something that they said would happen. So I started chanting more and more. And I started, you know, to try to, you know, I didn't trust it at first, of course, you know, because actually the stupid things that I chanted for, I would chant for like free cigarettes and some material things that I could see. But as you practice as Buddhism, what you learn is that, you know, we're material, we're physical, and we're also spiritual. So you, if something changes in you spiritually, something physically will change as well, all right, and vice versa. So if you chant, which is you chant Nam-myoho-renge-kyo is the chant, if you chant that, it, whether you believe it or not, it activates your highest potential in your life. And it starts, you start seeing it in your environment. So where you put this energy, you start seeing things happen. And, you know, we also think oftentimes that our lives are skin in, right? From the skin inside, that's where we live. But what you start to realize as you practice is that, you know, as many religions believe, you know, that we, our environment is a reflection of us. And that was really hard for me at first, but as I realized, as my life condition changed and became stronger and happier, the things that I drew into my life were happier, and they weren't as much, you know, there wasn't as much pain and trauma. And so this obviously took many years, but I saw tremendous proof in the practice without believing it. And I think that's what I needed. I couldn't go in with faith, you know. So this practice, this Buddhism, is a little different than other Buddhisms because it is, you don't worship a Buddha, okay? In this Buddhism, your highest potential, you are a Buddha. And that means that you are the highest form of compassion, wisdom, and greatness that is internal to you. So in the same sense where also, you know, the difference between that and Christianity would be like you could never, you know, it'd be blasphemous to say, you know, you're equal to God, okay? But in Buddhism, in SGI, Soka Gakkai, International Buddhism, you are the Buddha, okay, which means enlightened human being. So that's the difference of this. So with that being said, I finally started to realize, you know, my own life and the power in my own life. I no longer, and as you know, with victims of abuse, they've lost power. They've lost all their power in their life. And so therefore, you know, they tend to regenerate being victims in their circumstances.
That's right.
And it continues to happen, right? So for me, this was able, I was able to build a compassion for myself, first of all, you know. And the practice of this practice is, you know, quite stringent. You know, I've been doing it 38 years, and I chant every morning, and I chant every night. But it's not just that. It's also about other people. It's really about how you take care of others in your life in terms of helping them become happy. And there are no, I would say, to become happy, or let me go back to Nam-myoho-renge-kyo because it really is the basis. I don't know if you ever saw it. Did you ever see Tina Turner's movie, What's Love Got to Do with It, by any chance?
Yes, I have.
Okay, that was her practice as well. That's how she started practicing, was chanting this. And basically what the chant means is that you devote yourself to the mystic law of cause and effect through sound or through a teaching. All right. And that's what that is. It's also the title of the last, the highest teachings of the Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha, all right, 2,500 years ago. And it was the Lotus Sutra that he taught. And he had, you know, there's thousands of sutras. But this sutra was taught to show people how to feel joy and appreciation for their own life. Because once you, as you know, David, as you know, as we all, anybody who practices spirituality or has that, is that as you practice those things, you learn to become more in love with yourself, I guess, you know, and appreciative of your life. And therefore, you appreciate others. So by chanting this, it activates. It actually activates because it's not just, it's not that you believe that it works, okay, and it's not a meditation. You say it out loud because it's a sound vibration. It actually is a law. And law is, the mystic law is, for example, those things that we can't really explain but we know exist. You know, for example, we know that we rotate, the sun and the, you know, the moon rotates through the evolution. We don't really necessarily know how that happens, but we know that it does. That's what's mystic. Or the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. There's scientific reasons, but it's mystical to us why these things continually happen. So that's really the law, and it's a cause and effect. This one thing about Buddhism, it's non-judgmental, so you don't have, like, the guilt and the fear. It's based on scientific cause and effect. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. If you make a bad cause, you're going to get a bad effect, you know, and if you make a good cause, you're going to get a good one. It creates karma. So that's basically what that is. Yes, go ahead.
You've brought up a number of things that I'd like to comment on. Mm-hmm. First of all, I wanted to ask if you could explain exactly what Nam-myoho Renge Kyo means to our listeners who may not know. You've described what it can help somebody achieve. You've talked about the law of cause and effect. I heard you talk about vibrations, and I believe we live in a vibrational universe, and that it's very important to shield ourselves and surround ourselves with positive vibrations and to practice those things to attract more positivity into our life. That's what I believe. But can you explain what Nam-myoho Renge Kyo means?
Sure. Nam means, first of all, this is Sanskrit, so that it's an ancient, you know, language. Nam means devotion, and that devotion means how you would put your life into something. So in other words, you devote yourself to your work, you'll devote yourself to your children, you devote yourself to a partner, to a lover, to all those different things. That's the kind of devotion this means, okay? It's not something that is like reverence, okay? It's not that. It's actually, it implies action, okay? Myoho, once again, is mystic, all right? As I mentioned, the mystic law, okay, that we talked about. Renge is actually the lotus flower. It represents the lotus flower. And the lotus flower, there's so much in the lotus flower that is through our Buddhist practice. One of the things being that the lotus flower seeds and flowers at the same time. So it represents cause and effect. In other words, instantaneously, whatever you do has a reaction, even if you don't see it at the moment. So that ability to, you know, seed and flower is what that is. Also, the lotus flower blooms in the muddiest swamp, and it's the most beautiful flower if you've ever seen one. And the muddier the swamp, the more beautiful the flower. And that actually shows us in our own lives that if you've gone through the most difficult things, if you are in the most wretched places, because you are, you have that exact potential to have the greatest life and make the greatest causes and be the greatest person. And then
absolutely.
Finally, right? That's I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then kyo is sound or vibration. Okay, it also means sutra or like teaching. So through this mystic, through chanting Nam-myoho-renge kyo, and like I said, it's not something you have to believe in. You can sit there and go, this is total BS. But you try, you will actually see things happen emotionally and in your universe and within your environment. So and the purpose of doing this, okay, is to become absolutely happy, okay? And absolutely happy does not necessarily mean there are no problems in your life, you know. In fact,
right.
Without problems, we can't grow. You know, we can't build that spiritual, the spiritual muscle from that resistance. But through chanting, you activate this power in your life, and you learn, to me, which is the greatest thing as a person who was a victim of so much abuse, is you are in control. You have power. You have responsibility for what happens in your life, but you also have power, not only on how you behave, but the environment around you, because as you change, those around you change.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that answered. Yeah.
Well, yes, it did. You covered a lot of ground there, and I appreciate that. I think it's always very interesting when it comes down to law of cause and effect and spiritual reality, spiritual laws, that a lot of people are very out of touch with that, and yet if they took the time to study and see how we do manifest and reap what we sow, as the Bible might say,
right,
they would become believers. Now, the other thing I wanted to comment on was how you talked about recognizing that you are the Buddha. Each person is the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And that, in essence, that means that that person is God. Now, the church I belong to also believes the same thing. We use slightly different language. We recognize the Christ in each other, and that we all have that Christ potential, and that God is everywhere present within us, around us, everywhere, and that therefore we are God because we are a part of God, and we are all one with God. So I could very much relate to what you were saying. And that's a wonderful thing when you can find that common ground between different belief systems,
right,
and recognize we're not all that far apart, you know. And
right,
what worked for one person may not work for somebody else, but it's always wonderful to have different options out there, because there are people who have struggled with religion, have been religiously abused, have been abused in other ways, are seeking truth, are struggling to find answers, and there are ways to do that, and this, mm-hmm, this is one path, so I thank you for presenting that. Can we talk a little bit about your religious background, your early spiritual training, and how you have either hung on to any of those earlier belief systems, incorporated them into your SGI Buddhism, or let them go?
Sure. Well, I'm probably a better Christian than I ever was.
Oh, there you go.
I know that sounds kind of funny, but I think, you know, I was raised Catholic, and my parents were Polish, and, you know, that's a very religious kind of Catholic. It's kind of an old-fashioned kind of thing. And but it's also based on lots of tradition and things. And I was very, very interesting, because I was extremely devoted as a Catholic as a child. I had an altar in my my room that I used to have the Virgin Mary, and I would pray to the Virgin Mary, and which I think is really something. I loved her so much, and loved the thought of that. And you know, I really feel that the purity of that kind of prayer and that kind of devotion to an ideal of a, you know, loving woman, of a, you know, a spiritual thing. I think I still, that has become even stronger, I think, in some ways. And I'm very much back to the way I was in some ways as a five-year-old, because I see so much hope. And in spite of all of the difficulties in this world, I feel I'm able to do something for others and in a very solid way. Whether they practice Buddhism or not, I feel like I have a lot of power in my life now, and I'm able to, if I choose, when I choose and when I'm in the right mindset, you know, I really try to, on a daily basis, you know, bring that kind of spirituality into everything, which to me is just value, create value in when I meet someone, when I have a any interaction with the environment. So in that way, I feel that's very strong. I think that because I had Franciscan nuns, I had different kinds of nuns, and you know, as you know, depends on what group and what order and how they were raised themselves to practice, how they teach the children or other people in the parish. And the first group of people were actually Lady of Lourdes nuns, and they were the most educated, bright women. And, I mean, they were just like my Virgin Marys. They were these women that I just, you know, adored. So I was well-educated from them. And then, you know, and then I moved from Rochester to Syracuse and then went to a private school there. And there was a whole different group there. These were a very, you know, like very strict, all the horrible nun stories, you know, that you got. And it was interesting because at that time I changed my, by the time I was in sixth grade, I decided I don't want to be Catholic anymore. I mean, I knew it because of one thing that happened, and I remember it so vividly, is there was a new priest came, a young parishioner priest came into the parish, and he came to speak to our sixth grade class. And, you know, I think somebody had asked him a question about Adam and Eve and Garden of Eden. And he said, well, you know, those are just stories. Those are just, you know, represented, which you can imagine, you know, that was like freaking out. And but he was a very modern thinking person who was saying, you know, these are parables that, you know, teach us something, you know, but there was, you know, and there surely was a first man and a first woman, but this represents it. So I remember going home and telling my parents this. They were like, what? Well, he said, it's absolutely, you know, so there was this conflict in belief. And so I went back the following day to talk to the nun and, you know, say, you know, and I really didn't want to say too much, but I just asked again, you know, can you tell the story? And they were like, don't ask. You're to believe and you're to have faith and that's it. There will be no more discussion. At that moment, I thought, I'm done. And I left the school, and I asked my parents if I could leave the school, and I did. I went to a public high school. I mean, a public junior high school. So at that point, there was a big switch for me. But similarities, I believe, are, you know, I think, like you said, we reap what we sow. There are many, you know, what's good is good in this world, you know. It's in many different religions and many different places that you go, whether it's religious or, you know, it's your job or wherever. And I think that that's something that I see commonalities with people in religions is people are really seeking. They want to be inspired. They want to be their best. And I do believe that I respect religions that can do that. You know, I think the differences are I don't have guilt or fear anymore. And I think that my Catholic background was about that, you know, and you don't ask, and if you don't have an answer, you know, it's because you just have to have faith. It's God's will, which has never been a good one for me.
Oh, right.
And I don't think the big power is a man. I'll be honest with you. So but I agree with you. It's, you know, we are all connected. It's totally interconnected, and there's no denying that, I don't think, you know, especially even if you're having a problem with someone, you know, and if you have a problem with this person, they're probably reflecting what there is in you that really, you know, they're scratching something inside your soul that needs cleaning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're all mirrors to each other.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that with me. I wondered if you could tell us what SGI stands for and why in particular. I know you talked about your first experience when you went to an SGI meeting, but I'm wondering why it was that you decided to stay there. Was it just because of all of the happiness that you felt present in the group, and therefore you realized that you were at home?
I think that's part of it, but, you know, to stay with something for as long as I have, I mean, I've practiced all over the United States, and the one thing about, first of all, the SGI, what it stands for, it's Soka Gakkai International, okay, and so therefore, that's a tough one, that's why we call it SGI. And it is basically Value Creation Society. And the way this started was in the 1930s by educators. And two Japanese educators who were really seeking to improve the education system in Japan. And they also were fighting against the militaristic and Shinto organization, a militaristic Shinto religion that was running Japan. And that was really the reason why they were at war. You know, this was right at the brink of war. So they were imprisoned, the two leaders. It was Sanasabaro Makaguchi, that was the first president of the organization. Then the second one was Josei Toda, that was his disciple. They both went to prison and to say, believe in religious freedom, which was a really unique concept in Japan. But they basically had found Nichiren Daishonin. Okay, this is going to get a lot complex. Nichiren Daishonin was the first Buddha who chanted Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. He was a real revolutionary over 700 years ago in Japan. And he said, he was so revolutionary because he said that anyone can attain enlightenment in this lifetime. So the big piece was that the Buddhisms prior to that had said that women could not attain enlightenment unless they were reborn as men. That in order to attain enlightenment, which enlightenment means is to become a Buddha, okay, and to be at that highest capacity, you would have to go through many sufferings, many offerings, you know, many lifetimes in being reborn, reincarnations, to come back and become a Buddha. Nichiren Daishonin said, no, every person has that potential inside their own life. And that's with this practice, they can bring it out and truly become happy. So to me, that was, you know, the actual belief, the study of this really is why I stayed in this practice, because it's a lifetime study, as any religion is. But the organization itself was not based around priests. There is a priesthood, and they are in Japan, but our organization is actually part of the UN. And we're a non-governmental organization, part of the United Nations. We really base a lot of what we do on education and culture. We are very engaged. The head of our organization, Daisaku Ikeda, is a a poet laureate. He's a peace builder. He's really a prolific writer. He's got 239 honorary doctorates that have been given to him, and he's worked with Gorbachev. He's worked with so many people, and it's about peace. So that's one of the reasons why the organization has, you know, is so such a place I want to be at this point, and why I've continued practicing.
Well, thank you for that. Now, you've mentioned to me that world peace is a constant theme throughout SGI. What does this mean for somebody who practices this form of Buddhism?
Well, I think the main thing is that, first of all, there's a saying in our Buddhism that says, a great human revolution in just a single individual will enable a change in the destiny of all humankind. And that's really, it's from the book Daisaku Ikeda wrote about human revolution. And the point of peace is that if you're struggling in your life, for example, with my own issues, when I was young, I mean, world peace was not even a concept I even considered. I had to find my own peace first. And that peace is, very, it's not dependent on legislation. It's not dependent upon, other people, even in my environment, being happy. It really starts internally and then goes out from there. So from an individual perspective, okay, it's really about overcoming obstacles in your own life and really winning. It's never about learning to cope, or it's really about overcoming them completely and changing that karma, as we would say, into something positive. On a community basis, it's about helping other Buddhists, help them go through their stuff and care about them, keep them, help them practice. It's not about telling them how to live their lives. And being very inclusive. We have an incredibly inclusive organization. And there's activities for every single different kind of person that's involved in it. And so that is from a community perspective. And I think, from a spiritual perspective, the more people, sometimes we go, how can we affect world peace? I mean, I'm just one person. I'm just barely, making. I'm trying to feed my kids and do my job and, do the things I want to do. How can I really do that? And the way you can do that, whether you're Buddhist or not Buddhist, but this is our belief, is that through the good efforts you make, through you winning every day, through you contributing, you add to that energy, that positive winning energy in the world. And you'll notice that, we have a lot of negative energy in the world. There's tremendous negative energy in the world. But they don't ever exist apart. As great of the positive things that we do, we need to keep that balanced upwards. But we will see really negative things happen from that. Because out of that muddy swamp, once again, with that theme, comes real greatness. And we've seen that through disasters, in our society. Did that answer your question?
Well, yes, it did. And in the course of answering the question, I just wondered if you could give a personal example of transformation in your life. Now, I'm going back to something that you said, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but you talked about how you can turn around things that were troublesome and turn them into something good. So I'm just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that based on your own life.
Sure. I have 1,000 examples, seriously, of how that's happened in my life. But I think that the main thing is, more thematically, I'll kind of share with you. Throughout my life, I would, one of the things that was very profound is that I was able to have a child. I had a child, which was really miraculous, because physically they had said I was so torn up that I could never have a child. So what ended up happening was, very profoundly, someone said, don't ever believe that chant for you to be able to do that. So I chanted hours and hours and hours about having a child, and also if I didn't, how would I live with that? And would that be okay? Would, you know, all the different things in my life. And then I got to the point where I was going through so much pain, because the one thing about this is it doesn't mean you don't go through pain. You have to really face yourself, you know, and face mm-hmm. your own fears, and which are the scariest things in the world, you know, to do that. And you've got to look at yourself and say, and really transform that. So it was very profound. My husband and I, and, you know, he knew I was going through so much. I also actually had endometriosis severely. They were going to remove everything. I mean, there was going to be no chance. And the day before I went in for surgery, I had been chanting like hours and hours and hours, and these women were amazing. These SGI members would come and they'd chant with me, and I was in so much pain. It wasn't like I was thinking positively either, you know, like I was not able to really function well. The pain stopped, and I went to the doctor, and they said, oh, your tumors are gone, because I had so many tumors. And they said they have no idea why this happened. And six months later, I got pregnant. So, and I have a daughter, you know. So I had an amazing thing that way. But the biggest thing throughout this was that throughout the rest of my life, through my 38 years of practice, I would say probably about 7 years ago when I moved back to Atlanta, there was horrible things would happen to me. Like I would have my car would be broken into. I was attacked at school. I mean, just things would happen that were, I was truly victimized. And, you know, one of the things that I had studied was talking about you have to find that one thing inside your life that causes you great suffering, and it's a belief. It's something you believe that really causes you to always go in a certain direction or things to happen to you. So we moved down to Atlanta. Our car blew up. The van that we had, these people that moved us, held the car hostage and said, no, we want $10,000 more if you want your furniture. I mean, and then the same weekend, the dog dies. I mean, you know, it was like so incredible. And then we go to this Buddhist meeting and someone breaks into our car, the only car we have left. And I sat there and I started laughing. I mean, it was almost funny because it was like one thing after another. And all of a sudden, I sat down and I was chanting, and I thought, oh, my God, you know what? I think I'm a victim. That's my belief. My belief is I'm a victim. And the truth is of course I was a victim. I was raised a victim, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's all these karmic thoughts about why that happened to me. Did I make horrible causes in my past life, whatever that was? But what I realized is it really doesn't matter. It's what you do now. Whatever causes I've made, I'm able to tell somebody I overcame it. I overcame my mental illness. You know, I'm a very healthy person. And I learned that because I really found that answer deep. And since that time, I mean, stuff happens, you know. I mean, I've had deaths, I've had many, you know, but it's not the same. I'm no longer a victim. So to me, that's the biggest, you know, biggest win, transformation for my life is that, you know, I really am a survivor. You know, beyond just surviving, I'm a thriver.
So. There you go. There you go. I was going to change that for you. Yeah. I believe in thriving because we survive. You know, that which doesn't kill us makes us grow stronger, and we survive. But the trick is to turn that into thriving and to rewrite the story so that we are victorious and not the victim anymore. I had a guest yesterday who is a metaphysical minister, and she's from Hawaii, and she had an incredible life filled with much pain and suffering, lots of molestation of herself and her children. And it was interesting to hear her talk about how, as she went through these different experiences, she had started to practice some form of spirituality. I don't recall exactly what it was, but it doesn't matter. And when her first child was molested, she was about a quarter present to her true self, and the rest was victim and getting involved in all the why me and, you know, anger and judgment and all of that. But by the time it happened to her third child, she was able to lovingly approach the perpetrator and just calmly state her truth, looking at him as a beloved child of God instead of as some kind of an ogre, and tell him that what he needed to do was to pay for a year of therapy for her daughter and to take a year of therapy for himself and to attend AA meetings. And he agreed to do that, and she did not press charges against him. So I thought that was an interesting story. But getting back to SGI Buddhism, can you tell us what the three proofs are?
Sure. And I think this is a very interesting concept that can be used everywhere in all sorts of religions. But in Buddhism, there is an evaluation of religion that that we believe in order to say this is a valid religion, because there are many religions out there that are not valid, that cause people suffering, you know, and
right.
cause them, or you know, or even their interpretation of them causes people suffering. So the three proofs are documentary. So when you look at a religion, does the religion have documentation from the founder, from the teachings that make sense? Okay, and that's really where the theoretical proof comes in. Do these theories, are these believable theories that help you in daily life? Do they make sense? You know, are they consistent with the things we know are true, is in scientific proof actually? So where's that validation? And finally, the most important one is actual proof. By practicing this, a religion, whatever religion is your life better? Are your problems solved? You know, do you grow? Do you get the things you need to survive on this earth? And, you know, every year, is it better than it was the year before? And I think that, you know, that to me was the other reason why I was practicing Buddhism, because I didn't have time to die and come back, or die and go to heaven and get, you know, it was going to be fast if something didn't change, if I didn't feel that change. And I really feel I've been able to work through so many things, lifetimes, I believe, of karmic causes that I've made, good, bad, and ugly, to be able to have a real life of actual proof that when people meet me, you know, they, and especially when they hear my story, I think, you know, it's hard for me to believe, you know, some of this stuff now, but to see how I've untwisted, you know,
yes.
and really kind of have this actual proof of, you know, the lotus flower, and that, you know, I really have, I'm very forgiving of myself, so therefore I'm very forgiving of other people. You know, I've been humbled so much through my own, what we call a human revolution, you know, like this real revolution inside your life that you go through spiritual practice, and looking at yourself and taking responsibility for your life. That's really what actual proof tends to make you realize, is that, yeah, you've got power beyond belief if only we would not limit ourselves to it.
Wow. Well, I can hear the change in you, it's remarkable from looking back years ago. Because I witnessed the trauma that you went through and heard your story at a time when you were very much a victim. And you are indeed a transformed person. And what I'm hearing is the happiness and how you have changed your story. And that's a wonderful thing. I cannot believe it, but we're getting toward the end of the hour. So I would just like to ask you a couple more questions. How can people of other religious faiths benefit from Buddhism or incorporate it into their belief systems?
Well, I think that, you know, you don't have to be believe anything differently. Just similar to what you had said, David, you know, in your religion, you know, there's a belief that you have a your common, you know, spiritual belief with God, and you're also all Jesus Christ. I mean, there's this commonality. One of the things in the Buddhist practice is, you know, people can try it. They can. You don't have to believe that it works, that chanting works. You can incorporate it into your life. You can actually make it a tool because it tends to be more philosophical, and it fits into a lot of religions, you know, and you can try chanting. And look at the SGI USA website. If nothing else, the readings are amazing, and they're just very encouraging and will inspire you to even sometimes understand your own religion a little better, too, you know, like... Going, what goes around comes around, you know, kind of thing. It's really about cause and effect, but I think sometimes it's not explained well. So you can use Buddhism because we all, whether you practice or not, have this great potential in us, whether you call it God, whether you call it Christ, whatever. And it is a very speedy way to feel it very quickly and to start seeing actual proof.
Well, let me just ask you the million-dollar question, and that is, what is your current belief in God?
This is a million-dollar question. I don't believe in an external supreme being, let's put it that way.
I don't either.
Right. Okay. So I think that's, you know, I don't have that. And because I have another name for it, most probably, is why I don't call it God or spirit or something to that effect. You know, I really, I respect people who believe in other things. The only concern I always have about it is that people pray outside themselves sometimes and don't know that they themselves have the power within their own life to transform the situation. So I think sometimes you can give up and you can feel that the answer is outside you, and it never is. So to me, that I don't know if that answers, you know, that well or not, but that's kind of my – because some people believe in God the way I believe in my spiritual, you know, this life, actually, that force which is life, you know, throughout everything. So that's kind of, to me, what my God would be.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And I would like to ask the listeners to consider if there is anything external to themselves that can truly make them happy. And that's just a rhetorical question for you to consider. I will say that, speaking for myself, the only true happiness comes from within, and that is spirit, and that is God-centered. So that's my belief. Take it or leave it. It doesn't matter what you believe. Everybody's entitled to their own beliefs and opinions. Well, Diane, we've come to the end of the hour, and I want to talk to you later on. I'm not sure if you're free tonight or if we can talk this weekend sometime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whenever you'd like to.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And I actually have found the recording that was missing at the beginning. So I'm now going to close it and
thank you
say
so much, David.
That
I really enjoyed
now
it.
We can... Oh, great. So now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks to find common ground and take it to the next level here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.